In this episode of Startups for Rosvis, Rob and I are going to be talking about how to evaluate per seat and tiered pricing models. This is Startups for Rosvis, episode 375. Welcome to Startups for Rosvis. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
Well, my first ever angel investment in 2011 was Jason Cohen's WP Engine. And they just passed $100 million in annual revenue, and they secured $250 million investment from a private equity firm called Silver Lake, and it bought out the Series A and B investors. So it's my first exit, as they say.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, I guess it's my second exit, right? Because Drip was, and Hittail before that. But you get the idea. My first angel investment that has paid back any money. How about that?
Well, I've got a napkin folding company that if you want to invest in it, you know.
Really? What's the value? If it's low enough valuation, I think I could do it.
I don't know. That kind of reminds me of the joke I just made there. It reminds me of, I think that it was Jason Fried who had put out a tweet a while back about selling a small piece of Basecamp to somebody for like a dollar. And he gave him, it was like 1/1,000,000th of a percent of the business in exchange for that dollar, which made it valued at, I forget what it was like $300 billion or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I remember reading that article just about how you goose the numbers and it doesn't make any sense when you're raising. A lot of these VC rounds are just stupid, right? With Uber valued at whatever it was, $50 billion or just crazy, crazy numbers. But it doesn't mean you're actually worth that. And that was always a thing, you know, when I was sitting down to consider raising, as Drip was growing and we were kind of bursting at the seams and we needed cash, we were evaluating raising an angel round versus an acquisition because we were being approached pretty regularly by folks who wanted to buy us. And one of the struggles I had with raising that round or considering the round is it's like, I'm going to raise the valuation that you're going to raise at right now, given our growth rate and given our revenue, is going to be high. Like it's going to be a lot of money. And in order to then do, in my opinion, to do right by those investors, you have to sell for at least twice that. And so getting to the, you know, a purchase price that's 2 to 10x what your funding, you know, valuation was is hard because if you, let's say, I'm going to make up numbers here, but if you can raise at a $10 million valuation, you can't sell at a $10 million valuation. You could probably sell for $1 million or $2 million. Like the actual cash sales prices are always substantially less than funding valuations because funding is driven by the market and by FOMO and by all this stuff, you know, people making bets. Whereas someone putting cash on it, they look at more financials and they look at, you know, a lot, they're just more picky about things because they're not making a bet. They are really trying to do something that, you know, do right by their business. So all that to say, if you raise at a $5 or $10 million valuation, but you're only worth in cash, you know, if you could sell at $1 million today, you have a hell of a lot of work to get to that $20, $30, $40 million mark. And that was a big question in my mind is like, again, those are made up numbers. Those are not the numbers that we had, but I kept thinking like, are we in it for that many years, you know, or is it better to kind of take some money off the table?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big challenge, not, you know, just for you at the time, but like for anyone who's kind of considering going down that road, because if you do take that money, you're basically committing yourself to down the road, not just selling the business, but putting the business in a position where you have to grow to that point in order to be able to get anything out of it. Because, you know, I think in most cases, the investors are going to need to be paid back their money first before you get anything or before you get anything substantial. So even if you sell it, as you said, like if you raise it at a $10 million valuation and you sold it, let's say for 12 or whatever, like they're going to make their money. And even though you sold the business for $12 million or $15 million, you're probably not going to make very much at all just because of the way that those numbers work out, which kind of sucks. Like you built that business and yes, it was with somebody else's money, but you just don't get nearly as much out of it as you probably could have if you bootstrapped it. But you know, the flip side of the coin is if you didn't get the money, would you have ever been able to get to that point?
Right. That's always a challenge. And I mean, I think we've been clear in the past that like, we're not anti-funding, certainly not anti. I mean, as someone who is now investing in businesses, I believe that there's a time and a place and there are rational and good reasons for raising funding. We did an episode on this probably 100 episodes ago where we really talked through the difference between seed funding funding and angel funding versus venture capital, and kind of the pros and cons of that. And I think we talked about fund strapping during that time and about companies like Carthook and LeadFuse and Churnbuster, you know, that I'm invested in, that they don't necessarily want to do this series, the implied Series A. They really are raising that round up front to move quicker, but to get to profitability and then to build an actual business that will either exit someday or will throw off cash, you know, in the form of dividends. And so it is a challenging, you know, it's a challenging question. And I think, you know, I've kind of publicly stated several times that, like, I have no plans to do another one. You know, I don't plan to do another startup. I just don't feel like I have it in me at this point. But, you know, if in some theoretical world I were to do it, I would probably raise a round. I would either raise a round from myself, you know, and self-fund it, but with a substantial chunk of money, or I would go to the, you know, kind of my angel network and the people that I know and get some money into it. You know, because it just makes things, it makes things so much easier if you're an experienced, knowledgeable founder and you know the path. It can get you there quicker.
So instead of like the Bitcoin rage, I think right now is the initial coin offering, you could do an initial wall-in offering.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. It's such, the ICO stuff is so ridiculous. That's a whole other show. If you want to hear about that, go to nomics.com. That's Clay Collins' blog about cryptocurrency, and he has a podcast now, and he's diving into that stuff. But yeah, there's some serious insanity going on there, and I think the SEC is going to crack down on people offering these, essentially what their securities, you know, they're selling securities without vetting the people on the end, on the other end, and there are laws against that. So I think it's going to be kind of a mess for some folks.
Yeah, I've seen some crazy things, like some companies lately that are publicly traded companies where they have like a price on the New York Stock Exchange or on NASDAQ or something like that. And they come out with a press release or an article that says that they're going to be creating their own digital currency of some kind. And then suddenly, I think it was Kodak, it was just last week, and their stock price went up by 50%. I was like, really? Are you kidding me? Like, this is Kodak. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, having spent a long time in Rochester, New York, like Kodak goes through a cycle like every 3 years, roughly. It's Kodak and Xerox. It's like 1 year, a bunch of people are laid off, and then the other company's hiring. And it's just people bounce back and forth between those two companies like it's like clockwork, and it's ridiculous. But like neither one of them either really does anything.
Cool. So enough about ICOs and angel investing. What's going on for you?
Well, I added a bunch of customers to Bluetick this week, so that's a good feeling to kind of get back on track and, you know, kick things off in the new year. And right now I'm dealing mostly with support issues and finalizing the website design I've been working on and the email course redesign. And I think my biggest challenge right now is troubleshooting large numbers of requests that are coming into my server on occasion. So I'm trying to figure out either what's going on and why certain things are being throttled. And I'm sure it's a configuration issue someplace, but I just don't have like the logs, because it looks like certain things are just not getting through and I don't see what's going on. So that came up this morning.
Dude, if you have a segment.com integration, they have DDoSed us so many times accidentally. You know, someone hooks it up and they don't respect our rate limits. And we've had extensive conversations with them, and I'm just shocked that, you know, a business that large doesn't have, it's 429 response that we give back, and we say, you know, you're over this. This is a rate limit. The next time you can send is in this many minutes, and it's all in there. And we parse other, you know, Zapier has rate limits, and we parse them. You know, we actually respond to them. But Segment said they're working on it. But man, they have taken our API down multiple times in the past year.
Yeah, and that's what I'm dealing with. It's like I'm getting API requests coming in, and I've never really looked at the API limits in the past, because before it was just my app, but now as I'm starting to integrate into other things, you know, as you said, it's like you're basically accidentally getting DDoSed, and I can see in the logs, like, you know, I'm responding to dozens of requests per second, but if something gets dropped, I don't necessarily see it in those logs. So I have to go poke around and see, like, are there other logs that I can go look at, like on the system itself?
Yeah, once you have, you know, customers going and you start scaling up, these things take more and more of your time. So before we dive in, I had a couple books that I wanted to just circle back on. I, you know, as I say, I listened to a lot of audiobooks during the year, and I recently finished WTF, What's the Future and Why It's Up to Us, and that's Tim O'Reilly's book. I mentioned that I was maybe a third of the way through and was not digging it a few weeks ago. It definitely, I came at it with a new mindset, and I do think it's a good book, but it didn't blow me away. He, you know, he analyzes how the future is going to be. He looks at certain companies and how they're operating. And he did this back in the 90s. He did it in the early 2000s with Web 2.0. And now he's doing it here. And he says certain companies embody like what's going to happen, like where the puck is going. And so he looks at several companies, Uber, and he talks about Amazon. And he, you know, he talks a few about a few companies to do it. So it definitely got better for me towards the end, but not a resounding, like it was good. You know, it was a 6 or 7 for me out of 10, but it didn't blow me away like I thought it would. Another one is called Make Your Kid a Money Genius Even If You're Not. And I always like books that help me kind of raise my kids better and give me advice about that stuff. I liked it. I think it's worth listening to or reading. My one complaint is that it's so much focused on like teenage, college, and later. And so since my kids are 7 and 11, there was a little bit on that topic, but it was very, very limited. So I started skipping chapters towards the end about saving for college and all the stuff that I already kind of have done, how to manage your money during college, how to do credit cards and all that kind of stuff. And then the last one is a really interesting book I stumbled on. It's called Accidental Superpower. And this is if you want to feel good about the future of kind of America, and not in like a nationalistic way, but in a, you know, there's always the thought or the threat of like, well, you know, India and China and Japan and, you know, they're just going to eat our lunch and all the jobs are going overseas and all that stuff. Read this fascinating book. It's by a guy with a PhD in geopolitics. And geopolitics is how geography shapes like the political climate and how it shapes a country and how it develops. And it's just a fascinating look at all the advantages that, you know, that really that North America has as this place that's separate from Europe, about the Navy, about the natural resources. I mean, just on and on and on. He keeps going through, like, if you really look at this, at least from, you know, from his perspective, that America's going to be fine, that the United States is going to be fine, and that we can, there's always going to be challenges, but that it's not as dire as so many people make it out to be.
Awesome. While you're talking about that, it actually reminded me of something else. Do you watch Netflix at all?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a new series on there called The Toys That Made Us.
Yes.
If you haven't checked this, it's awesome. So there's only 4 episodes for it. So for the listeners, it basically goes back to the 80s and 90s and takes a look at some of the different toys that became huge and really, really popular during that time frame. And, you know, obviously some of them came about before that, but it goes through like some of the history of toys like Star Wars, Barbie, He-Man, and G.I. Joe. So those are the 4 that they have. I don't know if they're going to do another season or anything like that, but it's a really fascinating look at the toy industry and how people were marketing these toys, how they were getting them out in front of customers. And in some cases, it was like the psychological hacks that they used in order to figure out what was going to make a toy resonate with people and some of the struggles that they had to overcome in order to get the product out to market. It's just, it blew me away. Like it was awesome watching all 4 of them.
Yep. I've only done the Star Wars one, but definitely a show I'd recommend. I have the other 3 in my queue. So what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to be talking about how to evaluate per seat and tiered pricing models. And this comes up because yesterday I was talking to an entrepreneur about this exact topic. And we also have a listener question in our queue about SaaS pricing models. And the short version of his question is that on apps and services that host multiple projects, is project-based pricing a thing? What are the pros and cons and why would you not go down one of these paths? And he has a much longer version, which I won't get into, but I thought that it would be good to kind of dig into the differences between per seat pricing versus tiered pricing, talk a little bit about the pros and cons of each, and then also point people to a resource over on the Kobloom.com website where they have what's called the Ultimate Guide to SaaS Pricing Models, Strategies, and Psychological Hacks. And they dig really into, I think, about 7 or 8 different pricing models. Some of them are just variations on others. So instead of per user pricing, for example, there's a per active user pricing model that you can look at. But I thought that'd be a good place to start our discussion.
Let's dive in.
So the first thing to talk about is what exactly is per seat pricing? And the basic idea of per seat pricing is pretty straightforward. Each person that is using your software, you're going to charge the customer for. So if they have 1 user, you're going to charge them for 1. If they have 25, you're going to charge them for 25 users. And typically each user has a given price for it. Maybe it's $5, maybe it's $50 a month. But you can also have, I'll say, a little bit more complicated model where you have different tiers for the users as well. So let's say that you have one set of features, it's $5. A different set of features, it's $10 per user and $15. And I think that it gets really, really complicated. At least it has the potential to get really complicated, but in its simplest form, you just have per seat pricing is just a set dollar amount per user that's using the software.
Yep. And do you remember the rule for, I think we've talked about this, the rule for when you should use per seat pricing?
Yes, you mentioned it a couple of episodes ago, I think.
Yep.
If I remember correctly, it is if somebody is going to see like a different set of data or have a different view of what's going on, then they should have a per seat pricing model versus a tiered pricing model.
There you go. And so, you know, two examples is if you're using a CRM system, then, you know, each salesperson will obviously see different prospects and different flows. And that's why per seat pricing makes sense there. But if you're using an email marketing system, such as Drip or MailChimp, typically you don't see anything different if you log in. And so limiting the number of logins or managing, you know, by users doesn't really make sense because people will just share logins if they want to do it. I like per seat pricing a lot, but you should only use it when it fits that rule. And if it doesn't fit that rule, then avoid it and do one of these other approaches we're going to talk about. Because it feels weird when it's kind of bolted on. It's like really obvious when it's something like, why are you limiting by this? It doesn't make any sense.
Can you think of an example of where somebody might try to bolt that on and it doesn't make sense? Because obviously it sounds like you've got like a couple of examples in your head.
Oh, I mean, I've seen email, I mean, there's 500 or 600 ESPs that we've kind of run across over the years. And I've seen ESPs. So again, something like a MailChimp or a Drip have, you know, a maximum, you can invite users and up to 5 users to this tier. And then if you want more than 5 logins, then you have to jump up to a higher tier. And it just doesn't make sense. It's not providing, your customers are not getting value out of that. They're getting value out of either how many subscribers they have, how many emails they send, how much money they make. There are other things to base your pricing on that are not the number of logins. Whereas if you have something like, you know, PagerDuty, where, you know, it's monitoring software that pages your DevOps team, or a CRM system, like the more people you have on there, the more value you're getting, and B, the more kind of willingness to pay that you should have. So those are kind of two examples, to, you know, both against and for per user pricing.
So a couple of different, you know, cons for the per seat pricing that you already called out was that, you know, people will share accounts if there's no real value associated with having a dedicated login for them. And I think the other thing that I've personally seen this as well is if you are charging on a per user basis, it in some ways limits the adoption of that particular product, because then you're basically forcing the company or the customer to make a decision every time they have either a new employee or a new contractor come in. Do we create a user account for this new person, because it's going to cost us money to do that? And, you know, by pushing that decision on them, a lot of times the answer is going to be, well, no, we can get away without it. Or they go towards what you had pointed out, like they will just start sharing logins, and it, you know, becomes a detriment to you, because then you have to evaluate, are you going to enforce the logins on a per user basis? Are you going to make sure that only one session is connected at a time? Or are you just going to kind of ignore that issue?
Another con to per seat pricing, and again, per seat pricing works, but these are some, you know, potential negatives, is you do have a potential for increased churn as a result of fewer people in an organization using it if they are trying to save money by not you know, having everyone log in. So it's one way that people might churn out of your app.
So if we look at the benefits of the per seat pricing, it's really easy to understand. It's X dollars per user per month, and there's really no complicated explanation for it. Another nice side of it is that it does scale with usage. So you are not really leaving money on the table. If somebody has 5 people signed up, you're going to get paid for 5 people. If they have 500, you're going to get paid for 500. So you don't have to worry as much about whether you're leaving the money on the table or you're selling yourself short inside the app. And then the last thing is that when you have a number of users who are using your product, the revenue itself is generally predictable, because you can see not just that you have that number of users and it's a month-to-month subscription of some kind, but also you can see when people are not using the product. And if they're not using it, chances are good that you can forecast a little bit and say, well, how long after they stop using it does this particular user or account fall off? And then we no longer start getting revenue from it.
And that's where this variant of per user pricing that started to come about. It's called per active user pricing. And we're not going to dive totally into this, but Slack does this, right? If you have a team of 50 people, 50 logins into Slack, but 5 people don't use it at all during a month, they actually don't charge you for that. And I think that's kind of a cool way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a cool way to do it. And I think if you're large enough where you don't necessarily care whether all of your users are on the system or not, then that's fine. But I think for a lot of smaller companies, that also creates, I'll say, some pain points around when, you know, like somebody says, hey, can you hop on Slack, for example, and go take a look at this? Like, oh, I didn't get that, or I haven't logged in. And then they log in to check one thing, and now you're getting charged for them. It's like, okay, well, if they didn't have the login to begin with, then you wouldn't have to worry about that. But I don't know. I think for smaller businesses, you know, if you're between 1 and 5 people, it can be kind of painful, especially if the price point is more than like $5 a month. $5 a month is not a big deal, but if it's $50 or $100 a month per user, and suddenly you have 2 or 3 people log in extra just to check something, now you're getting charged for them because they're considered an active user.
Cool. So what's next?
The next one to talk about is tiered pricing. And I think that if you look back historically, I think it was Heat and Shaw with Crazy Egg. They're the company that I think you can kind of point to as putting together those different tiered pricing models. Another one is Basecamp, obviously, with all of their, you know, the different pricing tiers that they had. And being able to maximize revenue inside of their apps by offering a tiered pricing model. And the whole concept of the tiered pricing model is that within a given pricing tier, you have access to a certain set of features and a certain number of users. Maybe you have features in between the tiers, or maybe you have the tiers based on number of users, combination of those things. But essentially, it allows you to put those things in different buckets, so to speak, and let people self-select which one is the most appealing to them. And I think that this is interesting from the standpoint that you can allow the user to select those, but the downside is that because you're allowing them to select it, they could easily select the wrong things, or they may have problems deciding because you didn't put the gates between the different tiers on the thing that is most important to them. So there's pluses and minuses to this approach.
Yeah, and I would say when I think of tiered pricing, a strict definition, I think of it being based on kind of a single metric or maybe two. So an example to come back to ESPs is like MailChimp and Drip charge on the number of subscribers. And that's all the tiers go up and they go down based on that. And it's not also based on features, because I see feature gating as a kind of a separate or a more complex version of tiered pricing. But like true purist tiered pricing, remember Kissmetrics was based on, I think it was the number of events in a given month. And segment.com used to be based on the number of events. And I think it's actually different now. They changed it. And Zapier was like that. Like there a lot of, you know, a lot of these, it's not metered. Because meter would mean like AWS, where you get charged for exactly what you're using, but it's these tiers up to, you know, 100 subscribers and then 1,000 and then 2,000 and then 3,000.
I think the interesting thing is that if you go over to Basecamp's website right now, the only pricing that I see listed is it's $99 a month, all inclusive. So it used to be that when you went to Basecamp and you signed up for their product, you'd get X number of projects. And let's say it was up to 10 projects and unlimited users, but then you had a limit on the file storage, for example, the limit on the number of active projects that you could have at any one time. And now it's just $99 a month, flat rate, as many users as you want, as many projects as you want. And they've gotten away from all of the pricing tiers. So I think it's interesting to see the evolution that they've kind of gone through for their pricing.
Yeah, and that's something that's really common. I mean, if a founder comes to me and says, look, I'm just launching, or I have 5, 10, 15 customers, how should I structure my pricing? My advice would be go as simple as possible to start with. And if you're going to do per seat, then just do per seat. And don't do tiers to start with and do $10 a seat or whatever you're going to charge. Or if you're going to meter it, you know, then do your tiers and see what happens. Like get 50 customers going and see what the complaints are, see how the revenue stacks up, see if there's an opportunity to make it more complicated. But don't start out with complicated pricing, because it's hard to simplify things. It's easier to make it more complicated, easier to add a V2 pricing that has some, you know, differentiators once you have the data. And that's the thing is when you have no data or very limited data, it's really hard to make choices, and you're likely to make the wrong choice the more complicated you make things. So I do think that pricing should evolve over time. If you look at, like I said, segment.com's pricing is way different than it used to be. It's not even based on the same metric it used to be, you know. And as you said, Basecamp's different. There's most SaaS apps, if you look 5-6 years ago, their pricing is probably substantially different than it used to be. Even like MailChimp used to have a fairly linear pricing model, but now if you look at it, it's this very choppy thing that is like, it's linear and then it flattens out for like several thousand subscribers. And then it goes up linear and then it flattens out. And I'm sure that they're really smart over there, MailChimp. I'm sure there's a reason that they did that. And it's probably based on data.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at even at the bottom of Basecamp's pricing page, it shows how many subscribers or how many customers they've had over the years. And back in 2004, it was 45. And then 2006, it was 100,000. And now it's up to 2.5 million. So I would imagine they have a lot of data to be able to back up their justifications for making some of these decisions. And it's not like they really need the money either. So sometimes it could be just that they've gotten to a point where they don't necessarily care about it as much. And they just want to attract as many users as they can, especially on the higher end, because if you're only charging $100 a month, then it makes it very easy for larger companies to justify it and say, oh, let's jump on this because it's only $100 a month, and then you just get it for their entire company.
Yep. Makes sense.
And then if you look at a company like Crazy Egg, you go to their pricing page, they still have four different pricing tiers listed. And this is what I was talking about, where they will segment based on a couple of different metrics. So there are two lower end plans. It's visits per month and then active pages. So it's 25,000 visits and 20 active pages for their standard. And then below that, it's 10,000 visits and 10 active pages. So depending on which of those two metrics you need to pay attention to, you're going to have to choose either basic or standards. And if you go over one, you're probably going to have to switch over there. And then in their plus and pro plans, there's also advanced features that they use for that as well. So instead of daily reports, you can get hourly reports, and then there's advanced filtering and mobile heat maps, etc. So you can get more complicated, but as Rob pointed out, you have to have the data first. At the beginning, you're just kind of guessing and throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And sometimes that's what you have to do, but that helps you get the data. One thing about tiered pricing that had come up at MicroConf, Patrick McKenzie had mentioned this, where he was working with a customer and he ended up sending out an email on their behalf to their customer base and had offered them like an upgrade. And essentially he looked across the customers and said, well, how many of these people are close to the limit? And when he found that information, he sent out an email or helped them send out an email that basically said, hey, you are close to the higher end of your pricing tier. Why don't you upgrade and give yourself a little bit of headroom? And that was a very clear upsell to the customers. And that consulting client of his ended up making, I don't know exactly how much revenue it was from it, but it was sizable enough that it made a difference and helped them justify bringing him on and moving the business forward.
Yeah, I always felt like that was an interesting tactic. I've never used that. And it wouldn't, like, if I got an email like that, I would think to myself, aren't I going to be auto upgraded anyways? But apparently it works. And it's something that I know Patrick did with, you know, in his consulting gigs and got people to upgrade. Yeah. So, you know, in looking at this Kobloom article, they have, I think, six or seven types of pricing models. One is flat rate pricing. And that's essentially what you've said, you know, with Basecamp. And most companies, that's not going to be what you want to do. You're going to probably want to do per seat or do a tiered model that's based on one metric to start with. Another type is usage-based, which is pay as you go. So this, think of it, this is like Amazon AWS, you know, or Google Cloud hosting and Microsoft Azure. And this is not something I'd recommend for bootstrap startups, frankly, because just tiering winds up being a better way to go. It will make you more revenue, and revenue is so critical for you at the time. And then, of course, there's tiered pricing. There's per user pricing, which we talked about. There's this per active user pricing they have, and then they have per feature pricing, which is, it can't be done totally separately from tiers, but I've typically seen it as you have tiered pricing based on a certain metric, and then you also start sprinkling per feature pricing in there. So I know Zapier has done this. They used to have number of event executions per month. And then if you wanted to use like Drip or HubSpot, then you had to move up to a higher tier, even if you had the small amount of, you know, a small amount of events, because they figure that if you're using those tools, that you're, you know, a more sophisticated marketer and you have a bigger budget. So that's one example. And then the last one is freemium. Although, see, I see freemium as working with any of the above, right? You can have tiered pricing and then just have a free, you know, a forever free plan that is below those. So those are the seven models that they threw out just for completeness.
Yeah, I forget who it was that was talking about freemium, and they referred to it more as a distribution model, not necessarily a pricing model.
Right. Yeah, that's how I feel about it. And really, it's a marketing approach, right? More than anything else. And that's where, you know, I've my quote is that the freemium pricing model is like a samurai sword. If you know what you're doing, you can wield it with great expertise. But if you don't, you're likely to cut your arm off. And that's how you see a lot of bootstrap startups that just kind of launch with freemium, because isn't that what the big guys do? And then boom, that goes away. Like they shut the free plan down. I've seen dozens and dozens of companies, including Basecamp, used to have a free plan, and they do not.
So cutting your arm off sounds like a great place to leave off this episode.
It sure does. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from our Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.